Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for your kind words. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I wish to thank, first of all, the Heinrich Böll Foundation and its sponsoring partners for the opportunity to take part in this conference. It is obviously an honor to have been invited to offer one of the keynote addresses. It is at the same time a pleasure to engage in the study and analysis of a topic that has long been, for me, of professional and personal interest. I am, of course, also conscious of a weight of responsibility, a weight I am relieved to share with my fellow keynote speakers, to lay down, as it were, a common platform of interest, a frame of reference to help give shape and purpose to our deliberations. If a conference is a concert and the chairperson is a conductor, then the keynote speaker is something like a humble tuning fork that seeks to set the right musical pitch and tone. In a conference, we come with different interests, different concerns and expectations, and it is useful at the outset for us to explore what might be common intersections of thought, and thus to make sure that we are in the same conference. Let me start somewhat upstream of the topic, and in fact draw on some work that we did at IOM towards the preparation of our last World Migration Report. It is a sobering, if somewhat unsettling thought, that it is quite possible that the origins of contemporary mobility lie not in conscious decisions by the ministers who typically handle migration, or interior, or justice, as the case may be, and their respective senior officials, but rather in choices made by their colleagues responsible for trade and finance portfolios. Let me explain. Some 40 years ago, the international community made a crucial choice, a choice to embark on the development of a general agreement on tariffs and trade, the so-called GATT, which eventually begat, no pun intended, not only the WTO, but also the General Agreement in Trades and Services, or GATS. The important point is that it could have gone the other way. The nation states of the world could have decided to go for highly self-contained, enclosed, highly protected economies. They could have decided that economic insularity and tariff barriers were but a small price to pay for the retention of protected, self-sustaining national economies, strong national identities, social quiescence and harmony, and for a maximum of security within their borders. I mentioned that to Jan Carlson, who was at the time Minister for Development in Sweden, at a workshop we both attended in Oslo. And he thought for a moment, whistled, and with slightly wicked delight said, "Can you imagine all our Norwegian neighbors swimming in their vast pools of oil?" The issue, in any case, is no longer in doubt. To the distress of the altermondialist, the international community chose growth, and first of all, economic growth as its overriding objective. This is what all governments today, all over the world, accept as a priority. Whether the choice was wise or not, and there is obviously a lot of room for debate here, there follows a chain of consequences. Growth is achieved by increasing productivity. Productivity is stimulated through competitiveness, and competitiveness is all about being more efficient in the use of resources than the next country, whether across the border or across the world. In his 205 much-debated book, The World is Flat, Thomas Friedman developed the idea that the world is flat when barriers to trade, innovation, and information are leveled. Since we are in Berlin, it may be useful to recall that he identified the fall of the Berlin Wall 20 years ago as the first of 10 events that would contribute to the flattening of the world. Also included in the list and of relevance to our discussion were outsourcing, or allowing anyone with the requisite skills to do the job anywhere in the world. Offshoring, taking advantage of delocalization, that is, and the emergence of global supply chains. Friedman correctly pointed out that the removal of barriers would lead to increasing levels of exchange of resources, such as goods and services. What is becoming more and more apparent, however, is that one of these resources is human capital. Although the facilitation of the movement of this resource was, and unfortunately remains in formal terms, largely excluded from large multilateral commercial negotiations, such as the Doha Round, it nonetheless features more and more prominently in the equations of those seeking to maintain, or more accurately, in those post-financial crisis days, to restore levels of growth and productivity. It needs hardly to be pointed out that in developed countries and in Europe in particular, this assignment will be all the more difficult because it will have to be undertaken in a demographic context where aging cohorts retire to be replaced by much smaller cohorts of younger workers. There are, of course, many kinds of people on the move in our globalizing world, covering categories as diverse as family members seeking reunification, asylum seekers, refugees, and labor migrants, not to mention, we shouldn't forget them, business visitors and large numbers of tourists. But it is probably true that there is no group that is as coveted by policymakers as much as highly skilled migrants. But who are the highly skilled? There is, as you may be aware, no agreed definition. These workers are most frequently categorized through allusion to either their level of educational attainment, the cutoff point being generally 3 or 4 years tertiary study following completion of high school, or secondly, the professional skills they have mastered, or thirdly, the salary levels they're able to command. The bidding for recognition tends to start at around 50,000 euros for a year's work. There is, of course, no upper limit. Although the term highly skilled is sometimes reserved for use in relation to talent in science and technology, the term is commonly stretched to cover a wide range of educational or occupational backgrounds, including intra-corporate transferees, business executives, IT specialists, professional health workers, as well as graduate students. This list is obviously not exhaustive. Why are these people sought after? The reasons are as numerous as they are diverse. One prime rationale is to be found in the emergence of knowledge-based societies, requiring professionals, and I quote from an OECD paper, able to access, understand, and use knowledge for technological and economic development. Highly skilled migrants can operate as creators, multipliers, and transmitters of knowledge. They are valued for bringing a diversity of viewpoints and cultural enrichment to the workplaces that design and produce goods for the global market. They are also esteemed for their willingness to take risk, including, obviously, the risk of mobility itself, and their entrepreneurial flair and ability. It seems that they can do anything except walk on water. But let's be realistic, and I'd like to ask you the question, what do we expect the highly skilled migrants to do in Germany and Europe. By the way, while we think about that, we should perhaps reflect a little bit about whether we should make a difference between the highly skilled, those top-level people who make a difference, and the merely skilled who may also be needed to meet labour market shortages. Should we make a difference? In any case, there is fierce demand for the services of these people. And the competition is as much against other countries of destination, our chairperson reminded us, US, Canada, Australia, competitors to Europe. But more importantly, there is competition again for them to attract their attention. The highly skilled know what they want and look for best packages for themselves and their families. And lest we think that competition is only among developed countries, let us remember that India and China are saying more and more that they are now in the market to bring back the talent that's gone abroad and has been cultivated in countries such as Germany. The idea of attracting back talent is important enough for China to have incorporated it in their 11th five-year plan. I would like at this point to say a few things about statistics. As in the case for most migration data, statistics on trends concerning the mobility of the highly skilled are seriously constrained by problems of availability, access, and comparability. There is, unfortunately, very unfortunately, no international system that records the movements of the highly skilled. And seeking to obtain data on that population is much like looking in a broken mirror. The information is so fractured and distorted that it's hard to get a coherent picture. Here are some snippets, nothing more but snippets of information from those brave researchers who have tried to make sense out of disparate collections of data. Needless to say, I share them with a great degree of trepidation. There were, according to some accounts in 2000, an estimated 58.5 million migrants, let's say 60 million, in OECD countries, of whom roughly 37%, 20 million plus or minus a bit, who could be described as highly skilled migrants, depending, of course, on how you define them. In the same year, according to some accounts, among the 20 million migrants living in the EU, about 20%, 22%, had tertiary education. Compared to 1990, this share had increased by 7%. Most OECD countries are net beneficiaries of international mobility, with inflows exceeding outflows. In absolute terms, Germany and the United Kingdom are the countries with the largest number of skilled expatriates in Europe. Globally, the largest numbers of highly educated migrant workers are from Europe, followed by Southern and Eastern Asia. The highest emigration rates, over 40%, which is cause for concern, of highly skilled, are typically observed in small island states, or landlocked states for that matter. For example, from the Caribbean, Jamaica, Haiti, the Indian Ocean, Mauritius, and the Pacific from Fiji. A large proportion of highly skilled migration, and that's fairly well established, occurs within region. For instance, fully 33% of Western Hemisphere highly skilled migrants move to the US, especially from Canada and Mexico. Similarly, most European countries receive a large share of their highly skilled migrants from other European countries. A quick note about foreign students who form an important part of this tableau. The number of foreign students has grown exponentially since the 1980s. 800,000 in 1980, 1.2 million in 1990, 1.9 million in 2000, and 2.7 million in 2004. Governments have been extremely interested in that type of mobility for the last 20 years or so. It is indeed generally accepted that the global race for talent, as it were, as it's labeled, began in the early 1990s. The traditional countries of origin, US, Canada, Australia, had long been attached to the principle of selective migration, but now began to refine their selection instruments so as to be even more attractive to the so-called best and brightest. In succeeding years, both Canada and Australia adjusted their point system to place even greater emphasis than before on educational and occupational attributes in their selection process. Countries in Europe then followed suit with a series of carefully calibrated policy experiments, which have continued ever since, waxing during periods of economic growth, waning during periods of downturn, but never quite abandoned at any period in time. Point system, for instance, in the UK and Denmark, employer sponsorships, France, job seeker visas, Denmark again, conversion of student visas, many countries in Europe, financial inducements have all been attempted, modified, and sometimes, not always, evaluated. In one interesting exercise conducted in 2008, the Danish government asked for the development of a barrier catalogue to document perceived obstacles to the hiring of skilled foreign workers in Denmark. The exercise identified 25 possible obstacles, including, interestingly enough, the lack of appropriate family-oriented services to newcomers. One ongoing exercise deserving particular attention is the Swedish government's market-driven approach to highly skilled migration. The employer's assessment of the need to recruit foreign labor, the employer's assessment, is the key point when processing residence and worker permit applications. The individual employer has the lead role in this arrangement. He or she determines the need for the recruitment of worker from abroad and provides the employment offer, which is to be no worse than those specified in relevant Swedish collective agreements. Community preference is respected. Work permits are then granted for a maximum of 2 years, following which extensions can be sought. Such experiments are continuing at the moment. Hopefully, during this conference, we will have time to consider some of these policy approaches and weigh their potential advantages and disadvantages. Let me mention briefly in concluding some of the broad policy issues which hang in the balance. Highly skilled migrants, are they to have or to hold? In other words, should they be temporary or permanent? Are they seen as a revolving fund of skills to be changed every 4 or 5 years so as to have access to the newest thinking and technology? Or are they a long-term investment for permanent migration? Should programs be supply-oriented or demand-driven? Our conference paper lays that out fairly clearly as a challenging choice. There are two different perspectives. One allows potential migrants to apply on the basis of certain characteristics that favor general employability, and then they are let, as it were, loose on the job market, allowing them to carve their working space through personal initiative and know-how. The other, demand-driven, relies essentially on worker on employer sponsorship. Should there be room for both? The conference paper also lays out, very strongly I felt, an argument for policy coherence. It is indeed impossible to develop policies for the management of the mobility of highly skilled without linking those policies to broader adjoining policy fields. Obviously, labour market policies in general. Obviously, human resource considerations. And indeed, education policies. Consider, for instance, at least two strong connections to the education field: the issue of the recognition of skills, or the importance of retaining students after their studies rather than bringing in highly skilled migrants from abroad. Another important policy dimension is the case for partnerships. Indeed, there's a challenge in Europe, and I refer again to the conference paper, which points out the inherent challenge in the blue card of having members of the European Union work in partnership while at the same time having sufficient room to compete against one another. How can that blue card be made to work? But the partnerships are not only within Europe, internal as it were. Some important partnerships should be with partners abroad. The question of the brain drain is one which often leads to sterile debate, because there are so many entrenched ideological positions around it. In particular, there's the polarized debate between those liberals who would simply say, let free market forces operate and let people be mobile where they want to, and those who see the mobility of the highly skilled purely as a way in which poor countries are bled to death through the loss of their highly skilled graduates. I wonder, I've never seen it anywhere, but a wild thought occurred to me that there is perhaps room in this space for us to develop what I might call an ecological approach to the highly skilled. Could we consider them, or learn to consider them, as a renewable resource and introduce the concept of fair trade in that renewable resource so that no one loses out? I leave the question with you. Ultimately, it would be sensible of us to remember that there is no magic formula, not at this point anyway. And perhaps what we need at the moment is something more like a catalogue, a supermarket approach, a range of possibilities, a menu from which countries would learn to pick and adjust and adapt according to their needs. Nearly 20 years of policy experimentation in this field have proved at least one thing: highly skilled migration is unlikely to disappear anytime soon. How can future work in this field be made more purposeful, more coherent, more effective, fairer? I will listen with great interest to the answers that you may wish to put forward. Thank you very much.